Accession number 10657, Reel 9.
You said you'd remembered some more details about Ghazala that you wanted to tell me.
Yes, I think a point that we ought to make was that the only road there was in fact the coastal route. Anything else in the desert was caravan tracks. There were no towns in the desert south of the roads. There were the odd beers, that's B-I-R, which are wells, one or two old forts or piles of stones or empty oil drums which marked the caravan routes. And other than Alexandria, there was no large port until Benghazi. Matru and Tobruk were not in the same league as Benghazi. Can you switch it off just a sec? When the British forces retired to the Ghazala line, there was in fact a belt of mines from Ghazala to Bir Hakeim, which was occupied by the French. The infantry were in brigade boxes surrounded by minefields. East of the Ghazala line there was a series of strong points. The most important was Knightsbridge, where the 200 Guards Brigade were. The lines, the British and German lines, were not parallel in the north. On the coast, Rommel's forces were only a few miles west of Ghazala, but 40 miles separated German and British forces in the south. The nearest Germans to the 8th Battalion were 30 miles away. The DLI brigade was in a box, and there were gaps, minefield gaps, through the minefields. In that box was brigade headquarters, 6th, 8th and 9th DLI, the 74th Field Regiment, with huge camouflage nets over their guns, 505 Field Company, A Company of the 2nd Cheshires, machine gunners, the 65th Anti-Tank Regiment, 149 Anti-Tank Regiment, a battery of light AK-AK, and B Company of 149 Field Ambulance. 9th Battalion was on the right in the box, the 6th Battalion in the centre, and the 8th Battalion on the left. 3 miles in front of the brigade box, there were two outposts. One was called Strickland's after the officer had built it, and the other was called Petro's, after the officer that built that one. And at these outposts, there was a rifle platoon, a section of carriers, a gunner OP, and a section of Vickers guns.
I think you were going to tell me something about the rationing.
Yeah, I'll come on to that, yes. I'll just do this bit. 15 miles east of the box was Point 109, where the brigade B echelon was established with all the brigade quartermasters and the MTOs. The troops lived below ground. There were individual slit trenches. Weapon pits were linked to form a trench system in a platoon locality. Reserve ammo, food and water was kept in the section positions. Dugouts for battalion and company headquarters, cookhouses and reserve stores. The battalion headquarters mess had a table to seat 15, a wireless set and bookshelves cut into the side of the walls. The battalion lived, slept and ate in the slit trenches and dugouts. In the heat of the afternoon, only a single strand of minefield wire actually identified the fact that there was a battalion in that area. You couldn't see anybody at all, apart from the odd lookouts and sentries. And the trucks in the forward area were in deep pits, which completely covered them over, together with the camouflage nets. And there was a heat haze from midday until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And during those 3 hours, there was no movement by either German or British. Now, so far as water was concerned, it was brought up to us by the RASC water tankers. It was a warm, rather sickly liquid, whereas, of course, the Italians, who were much nearer to the coastal town of Derna, had access to what was called Derna water, which was very fresh and very nice.
Did you ever manage to get your hands on it?
Yes, we did. When we started the commerce raiding, from the Gazala box, whenever we captured any Italian trucks, which was quite often, the first thing to do was to find out where their water was and pinch that, not because we wanted to deprive them of it, but because it was better than ours. I can't remember that anybody swapped any of our water for theirs.
Why did it taste sickly? Was it?
Well, this has, of course, come a hell of a long way. It had come in the RASC water tankers, and of course it got pretty hot inside the tank. Can you switch it off just a second? Was that the RASC three tonners brought the water up to B echelon, where it was transferred to our own battalion 1500 weight water truck, brought forward to the battalion where the water was then filled into 2 gallon cans. The ration per man per day for everything was a half a gallon, and of this, 2 pints had to go to the company cookhouse for cooking. That meant that only 2 pints was left for the water bottle, for washing and for shaving. Dirty washing water was filtered and used again several occasions. Hot tea was the best thirst quencher, better even than the water. And we had tea in the early morning, at midday, and in the evening. Only one or two occasions of men actually trying to steal water from a water store. Out of the hundreds of men in the three DLI battalions, I think I only ever heard of about 2 cases, which, of course, was frowned on very much. When the rations were cut prior to the breakout from Gazala, there were one or two cases of men drinking rusted water from the truck radiators. So far as food was concerned, we had bully, biscuits, with tinned food such as steak, meat and vegetable, bully beef, processed cheese, cans of peaches and pears from the NAFI, which came up every week. Sometimes canned American and Canadian beer, which was buried, because a few feet down in the desert, it was wet and very cold. Never more than 1 can of beer or tin fruit per week. The flies were ever present. They were terrible. You couldn't wear a mosquito net all day or have one over you, so you had to put up with the flies. And they were quite audacious, to the extent that they would actually stab a piece of biscuit while somebody was raising the biscuit to their mouth to eat it.
Did you ever get issue with any insect repellent?
No. We didn't ever get issue with any. We actually didn't get issue with anything of that nature until we went into Sicily, when we had anti-mosquito things, because Sicily was pretty badly off down by the sea for mosquitoes. There was a free weekly ration of Victory V cigarettes, which were absolutely terrible. So altogether, you got the heat, you got the sand, you got the flies, you had very little water. As a result of this, you would think that people would have been very unhealthy, but they weren't. The exact opposite, in fact. A few had desert sores, but most people were very healthy indeed. There was a danger of dysentery, and therefore we had to be sure that the sanitary corporals with each company or platoon burnt all the refuse and didn't just bury it.
You mentioned in the mess that you had bookshelves.
Yes.
What kind of books did you get hold of?
Well, I really don't remember, but I think, generally speaking, there were always one or two officers in a battalion who'd got books with them. They brought them with them, you know. And I think that they probably fed these into the mess for the use of anybody else. But it was a big mess, the seat 15. And I think part of the idea was that, you know, if somebody wanted to go in there and sit and read a book, they were off duty, they could do so. We had a marvellous mess corporal named Corporal Cutty, C-U-T-T-Y, who died a few months ago, actually, who was absolutely fantastic and looked after the battalion headquarters mess extremely well. He would always find... he was always able to do something with bully beef or some of the other rations that you would never imagine anybody could do. And so he was a very highly respected man, and he never marched anywhere. We never minded Cutty getting a lift on top of the blankets on a 1500 truck, even if it was only for a couple of miles. We were quite happy for him to ride everywhere in luxury because he was such a good bloke. The routine with the Germans about 30 miles away, it was a fairly boring routine, really. We stood to at dawn. A CO came round the various companies. We then stood down. We had PT before breakfast. This was at Gazala, but when we tried PT at a later stage in Alamein, it didn't work at all, so we had to pack it up. But we did have PT at Gazala. Then there was a mug of tea, and in the morning and the late afternoon, that'd be after 3 o'clock, there was work on the defences. And the Durham miners, of course, were pretty good at using the windy picks, which is their name for a drill, digging slit trenches in the very hard earth. Then again, we stood to just before dusk.
Sorry, drill? What sort of drill was that?
Windy picks, pneumatic drill.
Oh,
that was there. The windy pick was what the Durham miners call a pneumatic drill.
So you had compressors up with you then?
Must have had, I think, yes.
Must have created a terrible noise.
Well, I think it did, but that didn't matter. You see, this was only in the initial stage of actually setting up section trenches in the Gazala line, with the Germans 30 miles away and never coming anywhere near our positions at that stage. We were virtually on our own and able to make as much noise as we liked. Is that okay? Is that the sort of thing you think is all right?
Yeah.
Right. Now, I think we'd better switch. Right. Early in April 1942, Rommel started vigorous patrolling, and 8 miles from the Gazala box, our patrols were shelled. So therefore, a big column was ordered out on April the 8th to drive back the German columns. But unfortunately, this was not a successful operation, and I think there were a total of 30 officers and men taken POW. This was a grave loss to the division, and I think that this was one of the reasons why I joined the battalion on May the 5th, because there were several officers lost on the Roscoe operation. I think it's interesting to mention that there was no British armour allowed to operate west of the Gazala line. So whatever had to be done by anybody was armoured cars, 6 South African armoured cars, or Bren carriers. In early May, Tim Beert, the CO, left. I joined on May the 5th, and Colonel Jackson of the Green Howards joined the battalion on May the 13th. He had been second in command of the 6th Battalion. He made it very clear from the outset that he didn't have very much time for Territorial Army battalions. But very quickly, he found that he had been posted to command a good battalion, and he came to be very much respected and liked by the men. He was a fine soldier and a born leader, and we were very fortunate to have him as CO.
He was a regular, presumably.
He was a regular officer, yes. It took the regulars a little, some of the regulars, it took them a little time. They didn't think that once the war had broken out, they should be posted to an untrained TA battalion. But Jake very soon found that this wasn't the case. He became extremely popular, and troops have followed him anywhere, actually.
Presumably, though, he did have a different approach to discipline and control, a different style of doing things.
Not so much as possibly some regular soldiers, because remember, it was he who, in fact, decided on the commerce raiding, that the battalion should carry out this aggressive commerce raiding. And from what I can remember of Jake, he didn't walk around telling people they looked untidy, because, you know, with the sort of uniforms we were issued with, the shorts and all that sort of thing, we all looked pretty scruffy all the time. So I don't think he was... I don't remember him as being a great stickler for smartness or anything like that.
You had quite a lot to do with the greenhouse, didn't you?
Not a great... No, well, the greenhouse, of course, were in 69 Brigade. The other brigade, or was it 5th? The East Yorks were in 69. I'm not sure what the Greenhounds were in. Yes, they were in 69 Brigade, because it was 150 Brigade, our 3rd Brigade, that got written off eventually.
But didn't you have a company of Greenhounds posted in the battalion?
Yes, but that wasn't until Alamein time. Mariopolis, I think.
Yes.
I think that was Mariopolis. I haven't come across that in the notes, but I think that's where it happened, actually. But on May the 27th, the German offensive was launched in the early hours of May the 27th. And Strickland's post was shelled. That's all we need to say about that, I think, don't you? And the 69th Brigade outpost at a place called Gabra El Factory was captured by the Italians. And that's G-A-B-R-E-L-F-A-C-H-R-I. Round about this time, the first of many foot patrols were sent out, and the CO ordered fast mobile patrols to hit the valley marked as many tracks and unknown to the 8th Battalion as the Great North Road. There was one broad track and several others running parallel, at least 400 yards wide, and it became a sea of sand almost ankle deep. I think on May the 28th we saw our first Italian fighter shot down over the box. I think you mentioned earlier on that did we ever get any Derna water? Well, on May the 31st, on the 3rd Commerce Raid, Lieutenant Hampson, who took out the raid, captured some Italian trucks, and they came back to the box with 30 gallons of Derna water, which was very much appreciated by everybody. Now, during the commerce raiding by the 8th Battalion, the armoured battle had been raging east of the Gazala line, where there had been heavy casualties. There were heavy and repeated attacks against 150 Brigade Box, 36 hours of intense activity. By June the 1st, 150 Brigade was in the bag. 3 infantry battalions and all the support, which left 151 Brigade and 69 Brigade in the Gazala box. We had, in fact, lost a third of our infantry force.
That's the division.
That's the 50th Division, yes. At this point, Rommel went for Bir Hakeim, where the Free French held all through June 2nd, 3rd and 4th, and after that. the early days of June, there were more commerce raids. By now, the carrier platoon were experts. They picked off supply lorries and troops from many tracks like ripe plums from a tree. It was a sort of highwayman activity. Bren carriers would break cover and go charging towards a column. There'd be a burst of tracer across the bows of the enemy column, and they stopped and were put in the bag. We got ammunition, we captured ammunition, Derner water, QM stores, and a variety of different things, including hot food, which mostly was a disgusting mess of macaroni, which didn't go down at all well with the troops. We also used to get quite a bit of vino from these lorries that were raided, and each member of the carrier platoon had his own arsenal of weapons. Not a single man in that platoon was without an oil compass or a pair of Zeiss binoculars.
It's rather surprising, isn't it, that Germans and Italians didn't actually put out counter patrols or send escorts with their...
Well, I think they were more interested at that time in protecting the supply columns that were moving across our front to deal with the Bir Hakeim situation. Now, they did have armoured cars sometimes travelling with those columns to protect the soft-skinned vehicles. And when that happened, our chaps had to get out of it pretty quickly because the German armour was more was stronger than our Bren carriers. And in fact, on one night patrol, which I wasn't on, they had a very rough time. They'd been laying mines, and a massive German convoy stopped just short of the minefield before the first one was due to go up. That had two armoured cars with it. One armoured car went onto the minefield and was blown up. The other one rushed over to where our platoon was and chased them around for about a couple of hours before they were finally able to break away and get back to the box. So they did have a bit of protection, in actual fact.
But they didn't send out counter-patrols?
No.
A sort of strength.
Nothing came out, nothing at that particular time came out as far as the box anyway. They did close in on Strickland's the early part of June, round about June the 2nd. They began to close in on Strickland's outpost, and this we thought was to try and stop these commerce raids. They also occupied the B-13 ridge, which had been used by our carriers as a lookout post and somewhere to hide behind the ridge for commerce raiding. So by the 2nd of June, they got wise to the fact that they didn't think too much of what we were doing and they wanted to stop it.
That close investment was in fact a preparation, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Assault further
yeah,
south.
That's right, that's right. Soon after this, the 9th Durhams were taken as part of a force to attack the Germans in the gap made in the British minefield known as the Cauldron. I think everybody will know that. And the attack failed. So now we've only got the 8th and the 6th Battalion left in the box, and the battalions had to be deployed to cover the area vacated by the 9th. And we also had to take over a new minefield gap called Auckland Gap. They'd only just finished these moves when there was a violent dust storm which went on for 2 hours. And these dust storms were really dreaded by everybody, Germans, Italians and British. The Khamsin wind from the Sahara. It halted all movement. It was an impenetrable wall of swirling, stinging sand. The sun was obscured, and there was an absolute cloak of darkness over the desert. The crews of armoured cars closed down and buried themselves under a pile of blankets. If you were unfortunate enough to be left out in the open, the dust skated on your you're caked on your skin and clothes, and your arms and legs bled from the stinging sand, and you couldn't see more than a yard ahead of you. Four Germans staggered into Strickland's posts, wearing only shirts and shorts. They were parched with thirst, their eyes red-rimmed, and they were exhausted almost to the point of total collapse.
What happened to them?
Oh, taken prisoner. I mean, they just lost their direction. They were pretty close. I would have thought they were possibly with the Italians, who weren't very far from Strickland's post at that time. Maybe they were out on a patrol or something. But they were finished. You know, they'd been caught in the open, and there was nothing they could do. I mean, if you were caught in the open, there wasn't anything you could do, because if you couldn't cover your arms and your legs, you just become a bleeding mess after about 10 minutes or half an hour, something like that. They were shocking.
What do you remember? What unit they were from? What sort of troops they were?
No, I have no note about that actually. Could have been gunner OPs or something like that, you know. But there was just the note in there that they arrived in the outpost, and then they would be taken back to the box. Around about this time, it was confirmed that British tanks were now able to operate outside the Gazala line.
Had you seen anything of tanks on your way
no.
up to the line?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, when I came up, when we came from the railhead to the Brigade B echelon area, we did pass. Every now and then we would pass an area where there'd been a tank battle or something. You'd see a knocked-out tank or something like that. But the tanks that were actually mobile, we hadn't seen any of ours because they weren't allowed west of the Gazala line at that time. And the German ones were a long way away. They did sometimes move fairly close to the columns, but mainly they let their armoured cars protect the columns going across many tracks and stayed back quite a long way. So we hadn't seen anything of that. I think this next bit is interesting. Two nights after this Khemsin, there was a foot patrol to the 69th Brigade outpost, which had been captured on May the 27th, but there were no enemy. So Colonel Jackson sent Valentine and Crusader tanks, this is the first time we'd seen any, South African armoured cars and battalion carriers, to the 69th Brigade outpost, and to recce a feature known as Point 169. At 7:30 a.m., the force moved off, and they were faced with very heavy artillery fire from a small depression near Point 169. One Valentine was hit by a shell, another had engine failure. Our chaps fired smoke, but they couldn't get the tanks back, so they were abandoned until the dusk. And at dusk, a platoon of DLI infantry and a recovery party got the tanks and towed them back. Now, it's very interesting that whilst this noisy recovery was going on, the enemy moved into a position facing Strickland's outpost. They obviously wanted to keep their activity secret, so they did not open fire when the tanks were recovered. And this, in fact, was the prelude to the attack, or to the Italians moving very close to Strickland's post the following morning.
So they were lying doggo while you were
yeah. While the tanks were being recovered, the Italians did nothing about it, and they could have done because they were pretty close to where it was all happening. Now this is where. Perhaps you can just turn it off for a sec, and we can say here, I suppose, then that a large force of Italian infantry was taken prisoner, and very soon after that, Stricklands were shot up by Italian fighters just before midday. They gave us quite an aerobatic display, in actual fact, before they got down to the business of trying to destroy anything, and they very soon destroyed it. They shortly destroyed an anti-tank gun on a portee and a truck. We fired back with Brens, but we didn't get any hits. We had no casualties. Then the fighters attacked again. An Italian officer was killed in one of the slit trenches, and an Italian who jumped on top of one of the carrier platoon in another slit trench was hit in the bottom. His bottom was neatly grooved by a bullet from the Italian plane.
When you say they destroyed the anti-tank gun on the portee, how did they do that? Was it just by machine gun?
Yes.
Fire.
Yeah. Yes, they weren't bombing or anything like that. It was all was machine gun stuff. And a truck as well. But mostly it was a sort of aerobatic display that they were putting on, you know. It was really quite interesting to watch.
You hadn't got any anti-aircraft weapons with you?
We didn't. That wasn't part. I mean, only the Brens. That was not part of the setup for Stricklands. Maybe they ought to have had a Bofors there or something. I think perhaps they did, you know. But they certainly didn't. I mean, I think perhaps they did ought to have had one, but there wasn't one there.